hearing on Senate Bill 1004, and we have some interesting legislation up today. And the committee will take a break, hopefully for about a half an hour, 45 minutes, before we go back again at... I'm not interfering, am I?
I'm sorry, Jeff.
I can't wait till we get television back in this room. And at 6 o'clock, the committee will take up Senate Bill 1205, which will be very interesting. So, we'll... and I want to thank Senator Courtney, who on Friday, in my absence, heard 17 bills.
17, yeah.
They're public hearings on 17 bills. Just a rainbow of issues, from common marriage to organization of migrant labor. So,
and Mr. Chairman, it was a virtuoso performance.
Was it?
It certainly was. You would have been very proud.
Well, you really helped me North Carolina.
No, I was not.
You were in North Carolina.
I was in North Carolina, but I was in Asheville, North Carolina, with NCSL. Okay, we'll begin with Senate Bill 1004 and Alton Brady and Linda Swearingen and Dan Ahern, isn't it? Well, they have David Ahern here. Whose writing is this?
If you don't like what I say, it's David.
And Scott Johnson.
Oh, hi.
As committee, if you recall the first 3 days, when we had an overall seminar on early intervention and juvenile justice, we heard about the fact that our female juvenile offenders require a different type of treatment and concern that we had not been facilitating very much. So they were going to hear an idea. Who'd like to start?
I'll begin. Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Alpha Brady, the Chief County Circuit Court Judge. And I'll tell you why we're here. We're here because juvenile girls historically have been short-changed, and part of the reason is that they primarily don't act out like juvenile boys. And I think the line is they act in. And as a result, the majority of the resources tend to go toward juvenile boys because they're the ones who are causing the most trouble. In Central Oregon, we found that we have extremely limited options. We don't have a secure facility for the girls. We have pretty limited options that are specifically directed toward girls' services. And so what we're attempting to do at this point is develop a continuum of gender-specific services, which takes into account that girls need to be treated differently than boys in terms of addressing their issues, recognizing that they have a lot of different issues than the boys. And what we are able to do is begin with a secure facility that's located in Deschutes County. We are already, we already have a juvenile justice facility. We have the facility available that has not yet been filled, and our Deschutes County Commission has generously agreed to offer that facility free of charge for purposes of the beginning stage of this program. And what we want to do is develop a continuum of services that begins with a secure facility and ultimately ends up transitioning the girls back into their own communities. We are initially starting this as a tri-county project just for purposes of convenience and the parties who are interested in coming to the table. This would certainly be open to all of Eastern Oregon once we get this underway. The reason we have it secure is for a couple of reasons. One is that we do want to address community safety. We do anticipate that there would be some delinquent girls there. But we are also attempting to address the needs of dependent and at-risk girls, and oftentimes you need a secure facility just to slow them down so we can begin offering services for them. What we're here to ask for, I think it's pretty clear in Senate Bill 1004, is that we are asking for some initial planning money that would be allocated equally to the three counties, Jefferson, Cook, and Deschutes. We would form a group to plan long range for the juvenile girls involving the use of the secure facility as well. And then we are also asking for operation funds to begin running the secure facility for girls, hoping that we can open as of July 1 of the year 2000. So it's for a half year that we're asking for. We want to do this right the first time, so we're trying to give us plenty of time to plan for this and make sure we have the appropriate gender-specific approach to these services. There's a package of information I've handed out. The initial two pages just give you some background. A lot of that information came from the Girls Summit that was held last fall. About three pages in, it actually shows the facility itself shows the outside of the juvenile facility. And then as you go through it, there's photographs of what the facility for the girls would be like. So you can see that it is secure. At this point, it's not furnished. We're hoping that all of those funds can be raised in the community simply through fundraising projects. We're not anticipating there's going to be any cost to actually have the facility ready to begin the program. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Judge Brady, I recall the facility that was built by the taxpayers of Chief County has a capacity of about 72 total, isn't it?
What's the total number we have? Oh, Scott Johnson, cover on that one.
Mr. Chair, we have four pods, each of which house 12 youth, and then we have an additional space, this particular space, capable of handling another 12 youth. So that would be 60 plus some holding cells. We can double up. I think if we doubled up and used all the holding cells, I think it is at about 72. And where are you at capacity right now as far as juveniles? And
we're using three pods. I don't know what the census is this week. They're not quite full.
And including in the planning, in addition to the 12th pod at the juvenile center, you're looking for six shelter homes, is that correct, in the community? And I'm probably getting ahead of you. Someone else is going to explain that part of it. But
well, keep going. You're doing a good job so far.
There's a tie-in because you need a shelter home. Sometimes it's not appropriate to have them necessarily in the lockdown. Sometimes it is. And so that area of transition with the community has been quite provided is an important element, I think, of the treatment.
And initially we looked at that fourth pod as a possibility and realized it was not going to be sufficient for protection from sight and sound from the juvenile boys. And so there actually is a shelter building that is physically separate from the pod, so it provides them with a greater amount of security.
Linda.
Okay. Chairman Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Linda Swearingen. I'm the chair of the Deschutes County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here to fully support, along with my two cohorts, Senate Bill 1004. Central Oregon desperately needs a secure treatment facility for at-risk girls. Deschutes County is willing to provide 2,400 square feet of our new juvenile facility for a secure treatment shelter space for at-risk girls. And as Neil had mentioned earlier, this facility opened up in 98, and it's an $8 million facility that Deschutes County residents have paid for. The residential space that will be available will house 12 girls with an additional six spots through treatment foster care. The space the county is willing to dedicate to this treatment facility includes three large bedrooms, a large common space, a separate entrance, and adjoining office space. We can also offer detention backup, potential expansion to 1,000 square feet of school space, and program support in the areas of cognitive training as well as alcohol and drug groups. And we believe that our commitment of $320,000 of dedicated space will go a long way, along with the state's commitment for funds, to make a significant difference in the lives of at-risk girls in Central Oregon. And we certainly appreciate you considering this at this late time in the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan?
Chairman Bryant and fellow senators, I'm here for a twofold purpose. One, I represent Jefferson and Cook County as a circuit court judge. We met with those Board of Commissioners last Wednesday, and I have letters of support from both of those bodies.
Okay. If you could pass those on.
So I'll share those with you. So this bill does clearly have the Tri-County support, as well as I can assure you it will have support of all of Eastern Oregon because the need is great. I'm also here to share with you one case history of a female juvenile offender that I hope will illustrate to you the need and the benefit of a program of this nature. The case history I'd like to share with you is a female offender that was arrested or cited June 9, 1996. She was picked up and charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, theft one, recklessly endangering another, and criminal mischief. The allegations of the stop, she'd stolen an automobile. There were allegations that alcohol and drugs had been consumed by her, and that also she was suicidal because when they stopped her, her stolen vehicle was veering into oncoming traffic repeatedly. She was placed in detention, released to her mother and given an appearance date approximately 12 days later. She was arraigned that day without an attorney. She requested an attorney. She was then set over till July 5th, at which time she was arraigned with an attorney. They set a pre-hearing conference that took place August 2nd. At that time, she admitted jurisdiction. The dispositional hearing was set over until September 20th to give the juvenile department, her attorney, and family the time to get some information about possible programs. On September 3rd, she was picked up again. She also led police on a chase. She again was involved in an automobile. She was again under the influence of alcohol and drugs, and she again was driving in a manner that indicated that she had suicidal tendencies. She was placed in detention on September 4th, ordered to remain in detention. The dispositional hearing date of September 20th was kept on that had been previously set. At the dispositional hearing, the juvenile department had indicated they had been unable to get someone to do a psychological evaluation, so she was released to her mother on a house arrest basis, and an appointment was made with the psychiatrist. That psychiatrist had indicated by the time of the interview and get the report to the court that it would be 30 days, so a hearing was set for October 28th. On October 28th, she failed to appear for the hearing. The court was notified that she had also failed to keep her appointment with the psychiatrist. She was then picked up on December 13th, placed in detention, ordered to remain in detention. The detention facility that Jefferson County used was in Umatilla County, and we were told that the state psychiatrist would see it away. We set the hearing over for about 10 days. At the date of that hearing, we were notified the state psychiatrist had not had the opportunity to meet with her yet, so it was set over until December 20th. On December 20th, she appeared. She still had not been evaluated. The court ordered into her 90-day evaluation center in Klamath Falls. Again, I serve a madness, so my one detentional hearing, she's in Umatilla County. I do a dispositional hearing. Have no information that gives me any indication why this individual was under alcohol and drugs, suicidal, committing crimes. In my opinion, just crying out for help. I ordered her into the 90-day evaluation center. She was transferred there, and she committed suicide within 2 weeks of her placement, still having not seen an evaluator. And that placement suicide occurred 6 months after the incident, and she had a second incident a month after the first incident, which also included felony offenses, and we're simply at a loss to have the resources to deal appropriately. Our resource that we can use is detention. By statute, that's not a long-term solution. The counties don't like it because in our county they have to rent that space for $100 to $125 a night, and they realize it's not getting us anywhere closer to the solution. So I'm speaking to you and encouraging you to give Eastern Oregon the resource that I think will improve, hopefully, the quality of life of our juvenile offenders. And I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
To me, why don't we hear from Scott first, and then we'll open up for questions. Mr. Chair, I'm primarily here to help answer any questions that you may have. Senator Brown, I think you had a question.
I'm just curious to what extent you anticipate serving young women of color and whether or not you'll have culturally specific programs as well.
We discussed that. When we first started the program, our primary concern was to make sure that it was gender-specific treatment. We used some experts in the state to get us on the right track. And shortly after getting on that track, we fully recognized that we need to deal with racial, ethnic issues as well. And so the program that will be developed will certainly address that issue. We don't have that issue as much in Deschutes County. It's certainly a major issue in Jefferson County and to some extent Cook, and that will be included.
And I can echo that sentiment. The fact scenario I gave you was of a female of color, and I service our county deals with the Lone Star Reservation as well as a very large Hispanic population.
President Courtney.
Thank you. Okay. The opening testimony was there's going to be three counties that pioneered this. They are Cook, Jefferson, Deschutes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But the language also says with other central and eastern Oregon counties able to participate by mutual agreement. Do I assume that by because you counties meet every day someplace that they all know this? I mean, how is the word going to spread to the big land out there that this project, this program that you three are going to be involved in, or the three counties, is available to the hinterlands of central and eastern Oregon?
We certainly meet with other counties around the state on an ongoing basis, and through AOC and our other committee meetings during the course of the year, this will be brought up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, the other thing we've done is work closely with the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium. Jim Moser in particular has been involved, and we've been in regular contact with Ed Schmidt, who chairs that group. And that's a real good conduit for communication between the counties.
Well, one last thing. We talked about a 2,400 square foot facility in Deschutes County. Is that in Denton, Deschutes?
It is.
Okay. you don't have to. You're crazy. I just asked you. What I thought was interesting is there was one facility moments ago when someone was describing this tragic situation. The chair said to me quietly, that's a 4-hour drive. So, but the fact is, if these other counties get involved, they're going to be facing a 4-hour drive too, because I'm not trying to criticize that, Mr. Chair, but they've got to get their kid to Ben from LeGrand or Joseph or Ontario, right? So we still got a situation that while Bend is centrally located, it's still a situation where there's going to be a long drive for somebody out there with a real crisis, not is at least available. So I guess you're not going to put a facility, another one in any other place. It's going to be Bend, and that's it for now. Is that right?
That's correct. That's it for now. It's part of it is the facility was available, and the other is it's a high population center. It's our hope, though, with the plan for the continuum of services, that once you deal with the issues that need to be dealt with in secure facilities, then that transition will be back to the girls' own community. So we don't have a situation where they're being released from Hillcrest with really no services in their home community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jeff. Next, we have Pam Patton and Dennis Maloney and Sonia Plumner.
Good afternoon. Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Pam Patton. I'm president of the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Access for Girls, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 1004 because of the effort to coordinate and develop a comprehensive gender-specific continuum of services that will benefit delinquent, dependent, and at-risk girls in Central and Eastern Oregon. And the reason that we are here in support of that is because that is our mission, to make sure and ensure that the girls get equal access to the gender-appropriate services that they need. We became involved in this bill because we're quite aware of the gaps and the barriers that exist for young women in Oregon to access statewide community-based services continuum. This is a particular issue, as you just heard, in Eastern and Central Oregon. We also saw this as a very timely opportunity for state agencies, local child service agencies, the courts, and policy and decision makers to focus on a collaborative, planful effort to deal with the continuum of services for girls. The reason that there are gaps and barriers in our system is that we have created as a state a juvenile justice system that was because of responding to public safety, focused more on boys, the child welfare system that, because of child protection, focuses more on children under 12, and a Commission on Children and Family system that, in dealing with what was called Level 7 youth, has focused more on the runaway and homeless acting out youth, but with very limited dollars, and also because this is a county-based plan, each county differs in how they respond, so it's again fragmented the service system to youth. 57% of the young people who are identified as Level 7 are girls. You heard from the judge about why we need to focus on a continuum of services for girls with a very specific example. I want to share a few statistics also with you about what the needs of girls are in our state. Juvenile arrest for girls' violent crime has increased 129% over the last 10 years, yet proportionately they stay 10% of our state institutional closed custody system and 20% of our juvenile justice system. Now, you might think of that statistic that this means we ought to build more jails for girls, but what we have to do is look at why we have this trend, and we have this trend because young women are responding in different ways violently, and a lot of it is based on their history of victimization. If you look at the crimes that girls are committing, they're committing crimes that are within their family or friends, that it's their relationship-based violence, and it has a lot to do with not being protected or taken care of by the families that they're living with. Also, if you look in Oregon, we have 64% of runaway youth are females, 40% of homeless youth are females. This puts young women in an incredibly dangerous environment to be victimized. 70% of girls on the streets run away to flee violence in their own homes. Suicide attempts are far more likely to occur by young girls. 79% of suicide attempts in 1996 were by females. These statistics are trying to show you that young women are in a very difficult situation and we are not responding to that need. You also might assume that because we have a juvenile crime prevention plan that is coming up in all the counties, that this will respond to the needs of young women. The focus of the juvenile crime prevention plan will be for a population of youth at high risk of crime. You heard the statistic that that's maybe 10 or 20% of the females. They are still in need of a service, and so but we can't assume that programming and funding for this first 2 years of planning and juvenile crime prevention will focus on these girls. The most promising solution isn't to squeeze girls into a juvenile justice system that's designed for boys, but rather it is to take a comprehensive approach to establishing gender-specific programming all along the continuum for girls who are at risk of multiple issues, including delinquency, an approach that can help girls who are already in trouble while preventing further delinquency. In closing, we propose support of Senate Bill 1004 as a good first step in establishing this coordinated continuum. We believe that Deschutes, Jefferson, and Cook County can begin this process and include more Eastern Oregon counties, and that the gender-specific secure treatment program will be a great addition to that continuum for the young women in Eastern Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Yes, nice to see you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bryan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dennis Maloney. I'm the director of the Department of Community Justice. I'm actually here for two very brief reasons. One is to be available to answer any questions about the facility of the program, and secondly, to introduce Sonia. Sonia Littlear is joining us today. We thought it would be healthy to offer a perspective from a participant in the juvenile justice system. Sonia was actually our most frequent participant during her days with the county, and she's actually now a student at the U of O and doing very, very well. One of the things I would observe is that when we knew Sonia as a customer of the juvenile justice system, that I think for quite a while we attended to her behavior, but I don't think we were attending to her needs. And the kind of program that's been described today, with also some help from some national expertise, will really attend to these girls' needs. So I'm very proud to introduce Sonia.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks. My name is Sonia Littlebear, and I'm here today just to share with you a little of my own experience as a juvenile. When I was a juvenile, I was on probation for a little over 3 years. And during that time, I was in various treatment centers, and one of those was a co-ed facility. And let me tell you about some of the problems that I encountered when I was in a co-ed facility. The number one priority for me when I was in there was to impress the boys. And the last thing I wanted to do was focus on my issues, on my program. And another thing that I saw in there were boys that had sex offense issues, encountering girls that had sex abuse issues. I found myself in that situation, and that class was a very dangerous class. I did end up, however, going to Rosemont, which is a girls' facility in Portland, and I was there for 10 months, and I ended up graduating from the program after 10 months, but the difference for me in that all-girls school was like day and night from the boys' school. First of all, I didn't have anyone to impress there. They were all my peers, and it was a peer-run facility, which means the girls held each other accountable, and they helped each other with their best issues. And in my opinion, what better people to be your support and your encouragement than people that are going through the exact same thing you're going through or have already been through the same thing you're going through. But the need for a safe environment didn't stop after a treatment center. After I left Rosemont, I had to make a decision of whether to return to my parents' home, which offered an unstable, dangerous environment, or to go into a foster home, which offered a stable environment for as long as I needed it. And I chose to go into the foster program. It was a foster family, Carol and Ray Curry, and their names. And let me just say this, as a college student today, on summer vacation, I go home to my foster parents. And that's not to say that I don't have a relationship with my real parents. I do. In fact, they live just four houses down from my foster parents. But I don't think that I would have been able to have the relationship that I have with my real parents today if I would have went and lived back with them. And I know how blessed I was to have a foster family that would just always have a open door for me and always take me in no matter what I did. But I know a lot of girls that I was in treatment with, they didn't have that kind of environment to go to after they left the program, and a lot of them ended up going back into the program or going down some rougher roads that they had already been down. Sorry, my spirits were there. The two things that I'm talking about, the all-girl treatment center and a long-term foster home, is probably what I would consider the two most important factors that helped me to turn my life around. And the fact that Central Oregon wants to offer those two things as a package to young female juveniles is incredible to me. And I'm so excited. In fact, I have hopes of, after I finish my undergraduate degree, to go back and work in Deschutes County and maybe help with this program and get it started.
I would just offer that Sonia did an internship last summer, and during her internship, she tested for one of our community justice officer positions and actually was named a community justice officer as a junior in college. At the end of the summer, I asked her, well, has this helped you decide what you'd like to do someday? She said, yes, I decided I want your job. So, we're here to help Sonia get my job. That would be fine with me.
Questions? Well, congratulations on your success. I'm glad you related to us your story, and I encourage you to tell others because it provides hope. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Dale Penn and Kathy Oscar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. Be very brief. We believe that there are insufficient resources for young female offenders within the system, and anything that can assist in that and identify new resources throughout the state, we think are a good idea, and because of that, we support the bill.
Thank you. Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project also wholeheartedly supports this bill. There is a lack of services anywhere in the state of Oregon, but definitely for girls, but definitely in Central and Eastern Oregon. And I guess the only cautionary note that I would have for the committee is don't think that just starting this program in Central Oregon will solve the problems of access for girls in Oregon. I've been representing juveniles for the past 9 years, and I was just telling Ms. Swenson that I have yet to be able to get a client into Rosemont because of the waiting list and the problems of essentially the lack of services for girls. It's a program that I just haven't been able to get a client even into, and most of the clients that I have that are on the waiting list for Rosemont that I can't get in there end up going to Hillcrest. So they end up getting the services, but unfortunately they end up getting the services at a much more expensive placement and in a placement that they really don't need that level of security, but there just isn't the beds available for them.
We estimate that the need in Eastern Oregon is probably 70 to 100 females that could benefit by this program. Of course, it's 12 secure beds and 6 foster beds, so it will not satisfy even our region. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1004. In committee, we'll open the work session. We have Dash 1 amendments to adopt, and then this goes down to Ways and Means. Thank you. And Scott Johnson, would you check with Mary? She's got some Dash 2 amendments revised for you to take a look at. You got them. Okay, good. Senator Courtney moves the Dash 11 amendments to Senate Bill 1004. Discussion? Objection? So ordered? That's Task 1. That is Task 1. Not 11.
I move Senate Bill 104 is amended to Ways and Means. Do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 1004 as amended to Ways and Means. Do pass. Discussion? First, Senator.
I assume Senator Burdick has no objection.
Senator Burdick? Discussion? No objection. Thank you. I will now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1009 and invite Dave Cook to come forward. Committee, this is a bill that I introduced. It deals with Measure 11 offenses in good time. In Measure 11, there's a prohibition against good time. This would allow up to 15% at the discretion of the prison officials on certain crimes that are incurred in Measure 11. It does require, because of Measure 10, a higher percentage of passages.
Two-thirds.
So it requires 20 and 40 to do it, but I thought it was time to have this discussion, and I appreciate David Cook being our principal witness on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. As you know, we are in support of the concept of Senate Bill 1009, and we ask that you consider some amendments, which I will get to in just a moment. The department does manage offenders currently through a whole array of processes, including the supervision of our staff, the inmate work, various other programs, activities, incentives, and sanctions. Options to motivate those people are limited, to say the least, when something as effective as earned time is devoid from that opportunity as it is on the ballot Measure 11. We think that currently, from what we know about inmates, one of the strongest motivators is earned time opportunity, or the loss of that earned time as being a controlling factor in how they abuse the system. We do take earned time away from offenders who engage in criminal conduct or in other ways do not follow the rules of the institution. Under your proposal and with our amendments, 1009 offers selected reductions in sentence for certain offenses. And again, let me reiterate that the department does manage earned time credit currently for a number of inmates in the system. Average earned time, although the cap for earned time on various offenses is 20%, the average tends to be about 15% usage by the inmates sanctioned under those sentencing schemes that allow for earned time. The department, on page 2 of my written testimony, you can read this into the record, or I can let it stand as is. I'll probably just go ahead and read it as amendment number 1. We propose that the following be added to, our proposal, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that the bill be amended to reflect earned time for the following offenses: manslaughter in the second degree, assault in the second degree, kidnapping in the second degree, rape in the second degree, sodomy in the second degree, unlawful penetration in the second degree, and robbery in the second degree. With that, we reduce all of the first degree offenses that were proposed in the bill from a policy perspective on the part of the DOC, and that we believe that the voters, when they were passing ballot Measure 11, were really thinking about those first-degree offenses, and that these are appropriately considered for the purposes of earned time reduction. We also propose that you amend the bill to read for a maximum earned time credit of 20% under ORS 421-121 sub 2 for offenders currently eligible and for future offenders sentenced under Oregon sentencing guidelines. The reason for that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that retains the 20% earned time cap for those eligible offenders either currently incarcerated or that will be sentenced under those sentencing schemes in the future. The bed impact in June of 2005 for all of the listed offenses in the bill was approximately 222 beds. If you follow the amendments and were to adopt the amendments proposed by the Department of Corrections, the bed impact would be approximately 151 beds as of June of 2005.
Questions? First, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you could stay, there may be some questions after other witnesses. That would be helpful. Next, we have Steve Dole.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole, and I'm president of Crime Victims United, and I'm here today in opposition of Senate Bill 1009. The reasons are as follows. 1009 does not preserve the principles of Measure 11 and the principles that were laid out in that measure that were very clear, I believe, to the voters. There was no ambiguity in the areas around the issue of release or early release or good time in that initiative. We have in the past been in favor of some modifications of Measure 11, as in last session when we were very instrumental with prosecutors and with the defense bar in the passage of Senate Bill 1049, which under certain situations for rob twos, assault twos, and kidnap twos, reduced the sentencing scheme and even allowed for probation under certain circumstances for those offenders. I guess one of the questions you'd have to ask is, where's the problem? Now, I don't pretend to be an expert in the area of corrections, but it doesn't seem I'm not reading about any riots at the prisons. I'm not reading about any great unrest. And in fact, the one incident that I remember that hit the paper here about a year ago, I was very interested in. So I called at that time Mr. Lockwood, who conducted the public relations for the corrections, and I asked him if any of the defendants who were involved in that incident were convicted under Measure 11, and his response at the time was that they were not. I think really that this is not a public safety issue, that it's a line item budget issue. It clears beds. It's a management tool. I understand that, but if they need a management tool, if that's really what this is about and not about dollars and cents, then what I think maybe we should consider is in the future adding 15% to these sentences and allowing that to be used as a tool to manage these defendants so that they don't follow the rules and regulations of the institution, they will have that added to their sentence. They'll have that ability to have it added. I recall looking at a report prior to or just after Measure 11 was passed that showed that most sentencing guidelines, people who were convicted under sentencing guidelines were receiving up to 17% good time. So I think that in most cases, the inmates receive most of what this good time provision is. Last but not least, I'd ask you to consider this, that the first time there's an early release under this bill and one of these people who are released under that provision goes out and commits a crime, that it will be right back in the lap of this body. And I don't think we want to go there. I really don't. So I appreciate your time, and I would be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Senator Gray?
I could have sworn since 11 passed, we've had conversations. There are certain sex offenses you're willing to have a lesser sentence or something on. Wasn't there some discussions like that on ballot measure 11? Did we do that, or they didn't get there? Where was that, please?
Well, if you recall, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, we came in the 95 session. Just as a bit of history, we came in the 95 session and requested that we take virtually all of the second degree offenses, with the exception of manslaughter, and be able to, under certain circumstances where there was not the use of a dangerous weapon or there was not a previous offense, et cetera, be able to put that back so that the judge had discretion. Now, we didn't get anywhere that year. Of course, that was the first year that Measure 11 was in effect. We came back last session and passed 1049 that included rob twos, kidnap twos, and assault twos. And we allowed, again, for there to be discretion to the judge and, in fact, to in some cases, give probation for those types of offenses. We weren't able to include the non-enforceable sex offenses last session, primarily because the committee chair in the House didn't want to go there. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, we have been on record of as possibly taking a look at that, because there are certain circumstances with those non-enforceable sex offenses, quite frankly, where there's familial situations where these people aren't being prosecuted, and it's actually to the benefit of the victims to make sure that that happens.
Well,
in view of that, why can't we get together here with what you wanted to do then and what the chair wants to do now, and see if we can't come up with something along those lines, so that we're not you're against us or against us. I'm very sincere about that. I mean, why can't we do that?
Well, I think that it's certainly something that we could, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, I think it's something that we can certainly have some discussions about.
And I'm not trying to speak to you, Mr. Chair, but digging into that, you're smiling, like, you better not cry, fellow.
Well, he sometimes speaks for me. I don't know if you noticed that. He speaks for the chair.
Okay. Well, I wasn't trying to trick anybody, because I do remember those discussions that you had, and so I was just curious. So thank you for indulging, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I know what you mean. Sometimes I have people speaking for me.
Other questions, Mr. Bill?
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We now have Pat Callahan, and I'll call up also Ingrid Swenson and Kathy Osborne.
Can we also call up Dale Penn from the ODAA?
You could.
Just get the whole
chair. We'll fill all four chairs.
Here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the District Attorneys Association. We are opposed to Senate Bill 1009, and there are several reasons for that. First of all, one of the issues about sentencing policy in Oregon in the past 8 years has been the idea that we need to have truth in sentencing. And the difficulty with Senate Bill 10009 is that much of what was intended with ballot measure 11 and what we tell people now about sentencing would be changed here. We've told people up front, this is what the sentence will be, and now we'll be changing the rules after the fact. I've had to talk with people for the last 20 years about continual changes that occur in sentencing and the frustration that victims and others experience when the rules are changed after the fact and they have no participation in that process. One of the selling points of ballot measure 11 was, and there will be no changes here, this person will serve this amount of time. And I've seen that portrayed in the media over and over again, and certainly I've participated in that, in explaining that concept. So just the philosophy of changing something after the fact is something that gives us concern. One of the things about changes in ballot measure 11, certainly we as an association have participated in trying to change and modify ballot measure 11 in the past. And 1049, the bill that Mr. Dole was just talking about, is something that we supported. One of the things about 1049 was there was a process built into the bill to deal with the cases that had already been sentenced. We would feel much better about this bill if it applied to those sentences proposed in the future, because then, as a judge was sentencing someone, as we were talking with the victim, as the media was reporting, we could be saying, and good time does apply to this bill. But 1049 set up a process for dealing with the people who had already been sentenced, had some standards on how you deal with them, and we feel that is a much better process. But just the idea about changing something that has already been promised, I think, is bad policy without some major revision of that issue. Another thing that I think needs to be taken into account is that when you change the rules after the fact, there has already been much negotiation. There has been concessions that perhaps district attorneys have already been provided or have provided to defendants in past cases. Discretion that's been exercised by the sentencing judge in the past, all built upon the idea that ballot measure 11 will not allow good time sentencing. So, concurrent sentencing versus consecutive sentencing. Allowing a plea to a robbery 2 instead of a robbery 1. A number of things like that. Charging or requiring a plea to one charge as opposed to two charges. Or two charges as opposed to three charges. There is a lot that is done in the system, and when we change the rules after the fact, it creates immense frustration with the people within the system as well as the victims and the people that were involved in the cases, and that's a major reason we oppose it. A second reason is that although I am aware of the concerns the Department of Corrections has, and I support the issue of control of the prisons and inmates within the prisons, I believe that the primary enforcement tool that the Department of Corrections has for the control of institutions is IMU, the Intensive Management Unit, the prison within a prison. And again, I would argue that the policy of not changing the rules after the fact takes precedence over this when there is the capability to enforce the rules within the prison system through IMU. The last thing that I would say is that we greatly favor Department of Corrections amendments over the original bill because first-degree crimes, attempted murder and conspiracies to commit murder, these are major issues, the use of weapons, the use of a gun in robbery one. We have real difficulty about saying to those major violent offenders, we're going to change the rules after the fact and reduce your sentence. It is much more palatable with the list of crimes that Department of Corrections has suggested. And if there was some way to deal with this issue of those who have already been sentenced so that we don't change the rules after the fact, it would be something much closer to something that I think we could support or at least not oppose. I would make, again, the observation, however, that three of these crimes already have a mechanism in place in the statute, assault 2, kidnap 2, robbery 2, for leniency, for greater reductions than the good time sentence that this bill would authorize. But I would acknowledge, as Senator Courtney has brought forward, certainly I have advocated in both party caucuses for mitigation of ballot measure 11 in the past, supported 1049. It's certainly something that we would be willing to participate in discussions on, but those principles that I've identified I think are very important to us, and I think a major concern, and that main one being changing the rules after the fact when we've already made promises to people in the past 5 or 4 years.
Dale, if we, and I certainly agree with the amendments that are proposed by Dave Cook, if we said that the law would only apply in the future, is there any problem in treating felons differently? Probably not, because proportionality wouldn't apply in this type of situation, but do you see any risk or issue there?
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to say that someone won't raise that at some point, but clearly that is a legislative decision, and the legislature changes the punishment on crimes all the time. And you have the capability to do that. And under 1049, you did allow some process, but that was not guaranteed, and it was not given to large numbers of people. So I think you clearly have the authority to prescribe in the future, this will be the sentence in the future, without any constitutional difficulty that someone in the past had a different sentence.
And I do agree with your comment and Mr. Gold's comment about victims' involvement. If, in fact, someone was granted 5 days off their sentence or 10 days or 5%, whatever it is, there should be a way to involve victims if they wanted to be, so that their comments on that issue could be heard. And that would be some other path that could be added to the bill. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief. I'd like to echo the sentiments both Mr. Dole and District Attorney Penn. And I guess the only thing I'd like to add is perhaps a little story about how the people of Oregon perhaps may feel about this. We see sometimes in the newspapers stories of certain special interest groups lobbying to cut down on ballot measure 11. And let me just tell you about a story in Multnomah County where a jury convicted a father or father figure of sodomy on his 10-year-old daughter. And the judge was very aware of the applicability of ballot measure 11 to that sodomy in the first degree. That's 100 months. So he immediately brought that to the attention of the jurors. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, do you understand that the sentence that I am required to give without any good time reduction is 100 months for this offense? Now, does that change any of your minds about the propriety of your verdict? Now, of course, I'm not going to say that that was appropriate for the court to have made such an inquiry, but having done so, I think that the response is illuminating. There was kind of a look around the jury room, and one of the jurors stood up and said, no, Your Honor, we think that sounds about right. Ballot Measure 11 changed the goalposts as far as the kind of sentences that are divvied out to violent and sex offenders in the state of Oregon. And I think that this is an attempt to get that, and our office opposes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we certainly support this bill. We believe this is merely a good government bill. What it does is to give the Department of Corrections a tool which it does not now have for managing inmate behavior, and it's a totally appropriate tool for that department to have, and it's a tool that most departments of corrections have available for their use. I think there's a limit to the number of sticks that you can apply effectively to a prisoner. To suggest that IMU is the solution for all behavioral issues and all motivation issues in the Department of Corrections simply fails to acknowledge that people respond to affirmative and positive rewards as probably better than they do to negative ones. IMU may well take over our institution someday if that is the only mechanism we have for controlling inmate behavior. There is pending in the House now House Bill 2083, which is a sort of different way of coming at this issue, and basically what it says is for Measure 11 offenses, you, the legislature, should add on a term which is not to exceed the indeterminate sentence which is applicable to each of these offenses, so as to give the department back the ability to extend stays so that they can control behavior, because the date comes for their release, there's nothing that can be done in terms of incentives for this offender, and so they lose control of some offender's behavior. And so that's one response you could make, is say, well, let's lengthen every sentence so that in the event someone doesn't cooperate, we can threaten to lengthen it further. Or you can apply a nominal amount, and that's what this is, of good time. We would support the bill in its original form, partly because the sentences for these greater offenses are obviously much longer. And so when you're talking about a 15% reduction, you're still talking about an extremely long sentence. But you're simply adding an incentive for that prisoner, as well as every other prisoner, to do the things that are required of them to get through this in the shortest amount of time possible. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. The other thing I wanted to mention was that burglary is one of the offenses that is subject to the Denny Smith amendment, and it might well be among the offenses that you would want to consider as included in this good time provision.
Denny Smith offenses?
Yes, that's ORS 137635, and it provides that if you have a previous conviction for one of the listed offenses, and then you have a subsequent conviction, that you are not eligible for good time credit. So your bill does address that population, but in the list of offenses that are included, it does not include burglary. It includes others, but not burglary.
Mr. Chair, that was the Republican Get Tough on Crime Act, I think, of 1983 or something.
1983.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. And I won't reiterate some of the things that have already been said. I would let you know how Measure 11 has impacted the juvenile justice system right now. Of all the beds that were built after Measure 11 went into effect through the money that was allocated to the juvenile justice system through Senate Bill 1 in 1995, almost every single one of them could be filled with a DOC inmate right now that is in the YA facility. So the what we're looking at is the revolving door that we had in 1995 in the juvenile justice system, which or in 1994 and throughout the early 90s and late 80s, we're getting close to getting to that situation again. Measure 11, for Measure 11 youth in that are juveniles, there is somewhat of a management tool that is available to them. If they act out at an OYA facility, they get shipped over to a Department of Corrections facility. I think it's interesting to note that approximately over 400 youth have been sentenced for Measure 11 since 1995. Over 280 was the last amount I knew of Measure 11 youth are in OYA facility. So we're looking at the majority of these kids are at least staying in an OYA facility for a period of time. That's a good management tool. However, when we deal with youth, one of the things that you need to remember, these are kids and they make really stupid decisions. for many reasons, but also because of their youth. And there's a lot of kids that call me that say, gee, you know, I did something really silly and I got sent over to the Department of Corrections. How do I get back to an OYA facility? And I have to tell them there's no way. Another way, besides behavioral problems that a youth can get sent over to a DOC facility, is if they sign a waiver. So in other words, a 16-year-old can sign a piece of paper without consulting a parent or a lawyer saying, I want to go over to a DOC facility and please ship me over there. Those waivers get signed for a variety of reasons. Anywhere from, I've been told at a DOC facility I can smoke, which is not true, to, I want to be tough and I want to be with the big boys. You're going to treat me like an adult. I want to be an adult. And so therefore I'm going to sign over to go to a DOC facility. I think that when we're talking about juveniles, a benefit of the good time will be for those juveniles that, first of all, are at an OYA facility and are staying there. Giving them the good time gives them some incentive to continue going in their treatment. After a while, for these youth, when they're there, they've done through all the treatment, they've done everything they can, and they're just sitting there at an OYA facility. They're smart enough not to sign a waiver. They're smart enough not to get in trouble. But there's also some incentive problems to keep them active on what they need to do. If they have that good time, They'll have something that they can work for, and that's important for juveniles. So the juveniles that are smart and either one way or another get over to a DOC facility, I think at that point it gives them an incentive to do something while they're there at the DOC facility, help get their education, help work on their issues. Last I knew, in January of this year, we had 3 16-year-olds in general population at the Oregon State Penitentiary. Those kids need something to work for, and giving them that good time, 15%, and give them that incentive to stay out of trouble and try to make it so that they, when they get out, they're going to have some benefit and some chance at a normal life. Thank you.
Questions to the panel? Thank you for your testimony. We will conclude the public hearing then on Senate Bill 1009. And committee, Senate Bill 345 is scheduled next in this session. They have worked out an agreement today and are going to work on some additional amendments. So we won't be going into work session on that particular bill. So we're going to go at this point to Senate Bill 686, going to work session. Person sent up a note asking that there was no finding sheet for these. That's because we've had a public hearing on them already. And so from this point forward, the testimony is based on invited testimony. But Mr. Taylor, why don't you first of all tell us about the amendments?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And they remember Senate Bill 686 allows a person not certified as a parole or probation officer to perform certain duties of a parole or probation officer. We have, I believe, three, and I think four sets of amendments to this bill. And the dash two amendments come from the counties, which broadens the definition of parole and probation officer. The dash three amendments come from Brian DeLashmit from the parole officers, and they are more limited than the dash four amendments, which come from us. And the difference between the three and four are basically that the three have additional prohibitions. A, relating to perform, would prohibit a paraprofessional here, I guess would be the term I've heard the people use, perform searches and seizures, it prohibits imposing sanctions, prohibits enforcing and monitoring conditions other than your analysis and monetary conditions, prohibits advice, direct, or guide offenders in any area related to supervision conditions, and any performance, perform one office visit with the offender except the community service, and then make sex offender notification. That's the difference between the three and four. The three have that, and the four do not. And then we have another set of amendments which came in from some of the verdicts.
The dash five.
Mr. Chairman, these amendments came through the Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Noley, who wanted the bill to be absolutely clear that the non-certified people would not be working in the facilities themselves, in the jails or custodial facilities, that they would be field people and not people within the institution.
He said custodial facilities, by that mean the jail.
Right.
It's not where we keep the garbage can and drop them off. And we have some people in front of us who would like to be in.
Chairman Bryan, members of the committee, my name is John Hartner. I'm the Director of Community Corrections for Washington County. And I'm speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors in support of Senate Bill 686. I'm going to discuss the scope of duties for professional staff versus paraprofessional staff. This was an issue at the last hearing and continues to be an issue. As you know, the Federation of Probation and Parole Officers in this state, which represents four counties of the 36, are opposed to our legislation as it exists. AFSCME is support of the concept that we are putting forth. Paraprofessionals have been used to assist probation and parole staff throughout the state and in some counties for as long as 20 years. The legislation we have before you is really to preserve existing practices that have already proven effective, efficient, and a method of enhancing public safety. Counties have always reserved as the exclusive right for professional probation and parole staff, the duties of search and seizure, warrants, arrest and detain, and the imposition of sanctions. In all our years of practice with paraprofessionals, they have never been given these responsibilities. I also want to emphasize that the language before you represents a compromise. Last biennium, the Directors Association and the Federation jointly agreed on language that stressed their two key principles, that paraprofessionals would always work at the direction of certified officers, and that paraprofessionals may not be the principal supervising or reporting officer of an offender. These two key points we retained in our legislative proposal, which is before you now. This ensures that the ultimate decision-making authority over offenders, whether in violation of the conditions of supervision, recommendations for revocation, will always remain with professional staff. The major reason the directors are opposed to developing a longer list of restrictions, as in Amendment 3 and Amendment 4, is because the use and need for paraprofessionals varies from county to county. In one county, they may be used in intake and to support community service. In another county, they may be used to monitor compliance of low-risk offenders, take UAs, make employment checks, or see who's attending treatment. The directors believe this legislation, which retains oversight by certified officers, and also the principal certified officers as a principal reporting and supervising officer, are the two key principles that are important for us to retain flexibility and for the probation parole staff to retain their integrity. I also would like to point out that many professions that use paraprofessionals do so not by a long list of restrictions, but through professional oversight, as we are proposing here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Klosser. I'm the director of Multnomah County Community Justice Department. I don't want to reiterate all the things that Mr. Hartner has spoken of, but we are in support of the Dash 2 amendments, and we are in support of those for many of the same reasons. Parole and probation officers are really the foundation of our department and the supervision of offenders, and clearly there are some duties which only parole and probation officers can do, things like arrests and detain, searches, seizures, imposition of sanctions, warrants, other kinds of things. But in our department, as in many departments around the state, it would be virtually impossible to really maintain public safety and allow certified parole and probation officers to do the duties that they are really expected to do and only they are trained to do without the assistance of paraprofessionals. And what we're essentially advocating is that that paraprofessionals be able to assist those parole and probation officers under the parole and probation officers' supervision. These amendments specifically really relate to the fact that parole and probation officers would retain those duties specifically outlined in ORS 137.530, and that it also clearly states that they are the primarily performing those duties of controlling, supervising, providing, or making referrals to reformative services for adult parolees or probationers. So we think, likewise, that it makes sense to pass the Dash 2 amendments rather than get into lengthy lists, because if we get into lengthy lists, then we're not sure, when you look at across the state with 35 counties, you know, did you leave some things out? Did you add other things? It becomes a very difficult process to manage. Also, and I think my colleagues can speak to this, to the Dash 5 amendments. This particular bill, 686, is a priority for Multnomah County, and it was discussed recently in one of our board hearings that the one concern the sheriff had is that this bill not be related to jails. There is nothing in this bill that currently relates to jails. This is only for certified parole and probation officers and for paraprofessionals who assist parole and probation officers. And we would probably not support these amendments because it is not there's nothing in this piece of legislation that is really related to jails. And there are custodial facilities like restitution centers and treatment centers around the state that are operated by community corrections agencies, but they are not jails. So I think I will just bring that up, and any of us would be happy to speak to that if that were to come up. But it is important that it not relate to jails, that this legislation not be involved or not in any way compromise the use of...
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question? At this point, is it hearing... I think it was my understanding that the sheriff really didn't want the paraprofessionals used in the restitution center either. I may be misunderstanding that, but it's your understanding that under your approach, the paraprofessionals could operate in the restitution center?
It may be that Sheriff Nolley does not want paraprofessionals to function in a restitution center, which would be appropriate because in Multnomah County, the sheriff currently operates the restitution center. But restitution centers around the state are primarily operated by community corrections, not by sheriffs. And in those facilities, in many cases, parole and probation officers and paraprofessionals do work in those facilities. So that kind of amendment would then impact many other counties around the state who operate differently. And that would be my concern. I don't think anybody would have a concern about it in terms of jail. And in our county, it's not, since he operates the restitution center, it's not even an issue.
Okay, to follow up then, the paraprofessionals would not be operating in the restitution center
in Multnomah County
under this bill then, according to your...
No, because we don't operate it. Community Corrections does not operate it, and that's just for... this bill is just related to Community Corrections.
Thank you.
Mary, you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Bodkin, and I don't know why I'm here.
You don't have to say anything. You don't want to, Mary.
Well, actually, I'm here because our local asked me to come.
Mm-hmm.
Several of our locals have asked me to come. And in its purest form, yes, we are supporting these amendments from Multnomah County, and we're supporting the bill with those amendments. Let me say, I've been on the phone about three times with my Portland office and with our staff rep who represents these folks. We don't like either one of the lists. And let me tell you why. We represent all of the techs and all of the paraprofessionals who are doing some of the non-supervision duties currently in Multnomah County and around the state. Lists always make me nervous because as I compare the two lists, and I was under the impression that Dash 4 were county amendments, and I'm not sure whose amendments they are. But when I look at the two lists and I compare them, the first item on the Dash 3 list is performs home visits or other field work. I look over at the Dash 4 amendment, then home visits aren't on that list, which means that a paraprofessional under Dash 4 could be asked to a home visit. Let me be real clear. We don't think that's appropriate. They're not trained, and we don't want them placed at risk. And so, having said that, we're going to watch this very, very carefully.
Thank you very much. Betty,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a little constitutional problem here. The problem is there are about three or four of us, and now three, there's now two. But the constitutional problem is, while Senator Brown is kind of coordinating, deemed himself equivalent to more than 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I don't think he can do what we are about to do unless somebody starts to come through the door. That's a wrap, folks. You're at ease. Stand at ease right now. Is it coming? Well, we're just going to hold it here then because... well, I don't... Not what I would like to do on this one.
I
want
to take more people who want to talk about the bill.
You...
Okay.
Thank you. Folks, any questions for these witnesses here? Thank you very much. Thank you. You can leave now because we've got some other people apparently want to speak too.
We're done.
Brian, how many you got?
I got half the room. I didn't know there was going to be such.
Well, I'm not sure.
Mr. James Street is also here, but I don't know what it is. Because it's different for the streets in rural counties.
Go ahead and speak.
Just hold for now, okay. So we. I just love it when they leave me by myself.
You're probably equal to more than one or two or three on your own, right?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Nice to see you, Jenny.
Can you take a hint?
Me?
You.
I'm not gonna reset this thing until I'm gonna stay here until at least 5. I'm not leaving.
And what he had said to the board is he was okay with the frustration as long as it didn't. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I've always decided that Sheriff Rundle is Peace Center. I mean, you don't have any care pressure. Well, if you took this and this out and just called a jail.
Well, this is still the problem.
But this is a problem, too.
be because a lot of counties do have.
How about them lasers? This is my kids' day at times like this. My kids have this phrase that just cracks me up all of a sudden as I'm going to listen. How about them lasers? What is that to do with that fits there? That's why we say it's like, how about them lasers? Like, it's like, what? That's where I am right now. Each year will come through the door. What?
I am not leaving until the 29th day.
Well, we can't do that. We're not doing anything until we get another body in here. Not right. Well, I don't need to cut out. Can he even testify at some here?
I didn't order any pad thai for you, Tara. He wasn't
definitely
here. Okay. I asked him. I did not ask him to help me out because he will not be back on that.
I guess we got burned on Saturday watching on Facebook. That's tomorrow night, 6 to 8.
Is it good? Bring Margie.
Yeah, it's just something you sit in on. You don't have to play it, right?
You don't have to play. You can sit and drink.
You know, I'll be very frank with you. Something has happened to me. I think it's... I had no particular reason. So much of it was like, all of a sudden, my older brother and I don't know where it is. He's the same age as me. I don't drink hard stuff and haven't for 15 years. And then I don't. God knows the last time I had a beer and I had like half a glass of wine, maybe 400 months. There's no particular reason. I didn't have any alcohol problems with my first half in the morning. And then my brother had it. I just don't know what it is anymore. I don't know what it is. Plus, I had a track coach tell me when I was really training hard to hit the coast. He said, I'm going to tell you something. Every glass of wine or every glass of beer you take wipes out a whole week of training. And he tells this track athlete that he looked at him and he said, I will prove it to you. So that overwhelmed me, that one statement.
Really? It helps you with your heart and stuff.
All I know is he's a very attractive said that he tells Nancy, this is why you shouldn't drink. You work this hard to get this level in terms of your track athlete. Mm-hmm. This amount of alcohol will wipe out a whole week's
workout. Plus, you're just like a weekend warrior like me. I work out 3 times a week.
Well, you know. Well, what you don't have, the thing, right, you don't have any weight problems, okay, so then, but what other things are you interested in terms of conditioning? And that's when you got to ask yourself, okay, not unless you have any other things, as long as your weight's down, you don't worry about any other parts of your body conditioning. It all depends upon the different parts of your body and the condition you want to have.
I have to tell you this because I know you would be excited, no one else would be excited for me, but you would. Jessie, our oldest stepdaughter, applied to St. Mary's, and she got in, mm-hmm. and she will be starting St. Mary's.
I think she'll like it. I'm sorry about the expense, but
we're not going to be doing child support, so hey, it'll be fine.
You should be very pleased about that.
Yeah, I am.
A lot of reasons. In the country, people think Catholic school, but not military school at all.
So impressed. We went down and visited the school, and it's one science teacher. She said the most popular club on campus is the science club. Probably not St. Mary's, if you're flying out there. She's going to be moving with us next fall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I feel bad that she's not going to public school, but Cleveland is the same size as the whole town of Enterprise. It would have been a total shock for her. Yeah. I'm so pleased. So.
and the Catholics wouldn't think of her about it. Because he's 25, the priest is going to be catechized now.
Oh, I think only 40% of the school.
You probably think that's what it is. Yeah, but that, I know, but that has changed. Because I was raised in Catholic.
I was just telling Sarah, I'm so impressed with the teachers that we talk to.
Mm-hmm.
The most popular club on campus is the science club.
That's
my favorite memory from Sarah.
That would do it. That would sure do it. Interracial marriage, I'll take care of it quick.
That's great. So anyway, I'm very excited.
You're very interested.
Diversity of things there. There because they're pulling scholarships.
Well, yeah, that's it. It's a very conscious thing the church is doing about inner city schools. Yeah. They prove the Catholic
Church. If you take the bus down there, she's there in 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
You should see in some of your big cities who's having the most successful games.
I'm sure the
pressure is there.
Anyway, I'm very excited, and you know.
And she likes it, right? She,
well, she's excited. It's going to be a change for her.
Yeah, let me ask. Do they have a dress code?
I don't think so anymore. They don't have a dress code.
Well, but see, the uniform. I have to track people. My son goes to class, yeah. They don't have a uniform, but they have, like, you can wear five different types of khaki and pants and shirts. And they, but I call it a dress code.
I don't think they have a dress code.
You know, it's crazy. Every other Friday, they get to wear whatever they want, so it's almost a riot if they come in here. Although, I don't think... So they stop you from wearing one or a few things. So the academics are taking
it. Yeah, I'm going to be a stepmom next fall. Yeah.
You'll like it.
Yeah. We'll see.
I think probably it's going to be a tough academic
course. Yeah, I think it's going to be a challenge.
I mean, I don't think it's... All I know, one, two, three.
All right. I really like Neil here, though.
I need to go ask him if he wants to be here during this thing.
Okay,
also,
here. I know. Doesn't it? It should.
I know. Okay, boss, can you live with that?
Is Jenny okay with that?
No, Jenny was swimming, but she was going to get the girl. Don't try Jenny.
What about the dad, too?
Well, you're not so cool. Don't you could just stand and know?
Kate. Okay.
No. Because I thought that was a deal. We didn't. What did you want to say? Oh, okay. Did you say you were going to testify?
For the record, I'm Rowan Gangsty. I'm the Adult Division Manager for Deschutes County Community Justice. I run the Parole and Probation Department for adults in that county. I'm speaking in strong support for 686-2, and want to be clear for the record, I'll try to be brief, that in polling those of us that operate east of the mountains for central and eastern Oregon, although they have not had the opportunity to see Dash 5, I believe I can represent that we would be opposing 3, 4, and 5, Dash 3, 4, and 5. There are two essential pieces that I just want to comment to add to what my colleagues have mentioned about 686-2, that in throughout the rural, more rural part of the state, which is largely central and eastern Oregon, there's a strong value in our communities about work, and there's a strong belief that offenders ought to do work to repay the damage done by the commission of their crimes. That's certainly true in my county. If it was required that we had to hire, short of clerical staff, that every other kind of function we do would be, we would have to employ certified parole and probation officers, I would have to basically not have a working community service program in my county, and that's the case throughout eastern Oregon because we wouldn't have sufficient budget to do so. Secondly, the idea of using paraprofessionals to support certified officers in my office, and I believe in many offices around the state, was not an idea drummed up by management, but it was an idea given to us by line staff. And my office certified staff approached me a number of years ago and said, look, what we're trained to do is be out in the field supervising offenders and working with the community to do that and make it a more safer place. We shouldn't be relegated to sitting in front of a computer, for example. And so it was their suggestion that we begin to use paraprofessionals in an area that we had not before. So my reason for mentioning that is just to make it very clear that this is an idea that is not meant to undermine the integrity at all of the profession of parole and probation, but rather to assert that those people continue to be able to do what they've been doing, and we have other kinds of paraprofessional folks that can support them in that task. And it's crucial for us, especially when we have a limited number of staff and a limited number of options, to be able to keep that kind of flexibility in our respective operations. And again, I checked that out via email with my colleagues east of the mountains, and they were all supportive of Dash 2. Thank you.
That's my fault. I overlooked him. I apologize. You're going to check out right from Mary. So I apologize, sir. That's not my fault. I do that.
And I have to use someone from Chief County.
I know it. That's maybe good to be back.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Brian, why don't you come forward, and if you'd like to bring someone with you, you're certainly welcome to.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeWeisman, representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. With me is Lucinda Carroll and a couple people. Actually, I'm hoping to get through this relatively quickly. It was my understanding that there really wasn't going to be a full-blown hearing. We've already had the hearing on this.
Right.
And
the chair too.
Yeah, and it was my understanding that my only function today was to explain the differences between the twos, the threes, and the fours, and that's the function I guess I'm going to try and give you right now. Dash twos, my understanding, are coming from the counties as a clarification to the original bill. As you recall, in the original bill, my membership was very concerned about the language of that bill. Specifically, and actually the Dash 2s do not assist us in making us feel a lot better. If you look at the original bill on line 5, page 1, they perform certain duties. There was a lot of concern by committee members, some who are here and some who are not here today, about what is certain duties. And allowing a county-by-county definition of what certain duties would be, my understanding was unacceptable. So from that kind of perspective, it was our instructions, or at least my understanding of our instructions by committee staff, that several of us would go away and discuss this and see if we couldn't come to some resolution as to what we were really talking about here in the area of duties and some other problems with the bill. In doing so, I asked my folks to give me a list, and I do not like the idea of listing, but give me a list of those things that they thought were exclusive duties of parole officers. And anything on that list, not on that list, would in fact then be up for grabs for paraprofessionals, but only under the direction and supervision of parole and probation officers. Let me make one correction to the previous speaker from Deschutes County. If he looks at the list under the -3 or the -4, community service, which is one of his major concerns, is not an exclusive to PO. That is something that the parole officer said a paraprofessional could in fact do, but under the direction or supervision of a parole officer. So I just wanted to let you know that we don't have a disagreement with them on that particular issue. Give you a little more history. My folks had a list of 15. That's the -3 amendments. Same, with one addition, it said initiation, direction, and supervision, where the original bill said direction and supervision. And then we said these 15 functions are exclusive to parole and probation officers. Other functions that are not on the list can be performed by a paraprofessional if under the initiation, direction, and supervision. The -4 amendments, which in essence kind of arose out of the discussions and really kind of, I think, directed by staff and the chair, are those items that both sides could agree to disagree to agree on. Let me clarify that. We had 15 items. They had 5 that they said were exclusive to PO. After 2 of us explored their list of 5 and our list of 15, we found out that it wasn't 5 and 15, therefore 10 remaining. We found that their 5 really was 9. Because of the language differences, we clarified that there was 9 places where there was an agreement that those are functions that POs should be doing and not paraprofessionals. That left 6. The -4 amendment coming from staff and the chair are a delineation of the 9 that are agreed and the 6 that are not agreed, but with the clarification, those 6 can be performed by paraprofessionals under the initiation, direction, and supervision of a parole and probation officer. Now, the only additional statement that I'll make is obviously using the word or the term supervision in this statute caused, having gone through the collective bargaining wars and legislation in here, caused some of our folks concern about, okay, all of a sudden if the term supervision is used in conjunction with their work, are they therefore supervisory personnel and no longer eligible to be a part of a collective bargaining unit? So both the 3s and the 4s clarify that for purposes of this specific function of supervising this paraprofessional, that this in itself does not disqualify them from a collective bargaining unit. So you now have the 2s, the 3s, and the 4s. We strongly oppose the 2s. Doesn't solve the issue of certain duties at all. We think the 4s list those duties that my folks think are exclusive to POs for public safety, and the 4s are coming from the staff and the chair.
And the 5?
The 5, my understanding, come from Dan Nolley in Multnomah County. This is the first I've seen of them. My understanding of the 5s is, what he's saying is, I want to protect my turf. I don't want paraprofessionals working in my situation, therefore I want amendments specific to in the facilities, but it's all right as long as I don't have to deal with it to be out there. We would oppose those. We think the policy issue is public safety both in and outside, and we don't think there's any reason for those amendments.
Chairman,
yeah.
He wanted those amendments just to make sure that the bill didn't apply to the jail and the recitation center, and I think it's the intent of the bill not to apply those places, so that was what he wanted to make sure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I'm going to move the -4 amendments and make everyone unhappy.
Mr. Brown moves the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 686. For folks sitting here, what that means, any senator going to work session, in work session, can move an amendment. And once that happens, that's the topic of discussion before the committee. Is there a discussion? Your objection? Stored. So the DAS 4 amendments now have been adopted in Senate Bill 686.
Yes. Senate Bill 686.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 686 to the floor with the DUPAC recommendation. As amended, discussion? Objection? Stored. Thank you. Thank you for your patience and your testimony.
Are we down here at 6?
We are, and we have two real quick ones that won't take much time. Let's go to Senate Bill 685.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 685 comes to you from the same people who gave us Senate Bill 686. And what it does includes in the definition of parole and probation officer a part-time officer employed by the Department of Corrections or County who supervises adult parolees and probationers. You have in front of you the DAS 1 and DAS 2 amendments that come from the counties in DAS Navajo. The DAS 1 amendments define parole and probation officer. The DAS 2 amendments state that a part-time probation parole officer must complete annually at least 20 hours in continuing education for DPSC.
Okay. I'm looking for I'll ask. Are these consensus amendments?
Yes.
Both the DAS ones and the DAS twos?
Yes.
And you're in support of both?
We're in support of both.
Okay, thank you. Senator Brown.
I would move the DAS 1 amendment.
Senator Brown moves the DAS 1 amendment to Senate Bill 685. Discussion? Objection?
I move the DAS 2 amendments to Senate Bill 685.
Senator Brown moves the DAS 2 amendments to Senate Bill 685. Discussion? Objection? Order. Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 685 to the floor as amended with the DUPAC recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Order.
Thank you. I think the carrier should be Senator Bryant since it would be two county bills.
I have carried it. Thank you for
bringing
that up.
Mr. Chair, can you carry that one
off? Oh, I think it'd be a wonderful experience for Senator Courtney.
Since he handled the hearing. Okay, hey, Senator Courtney, you're watching.
Yeah, what the heck? I don't mind being a... Go ahead, that's fine.
Now go into work session on Senate Bill 59, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have the DAS 11 amendments before you. This bill relates to, the original bill relates to the guns in courthouses. You have the DAS 11 amendments in front of you that relate to guns on transit vehicles. So what is happening is the amendments are being just to mass transit vehicles means a school bus or a bus or train operated by a mass transit district or transportation district organized under ORS Chapter 267 or organized by a city or county. So that would not include trailways or Amtrak, chair members of the committee. What it does is it creates a new definition for mass transit vehicles separate and apart from public buildings, so it does not get into the issue of the grounds adjacent to, etc. And then over on page 2 on the section 2 of the bill, which is your penalty provision, it puts mass transit vehicle after public building. It keeps all the exceptions that are now currently in the law as it relates to public building. And then adds another one, which would be a person who possesses a firearm while in a mass transit vehicle. If the person does not possess any firearm and ammunition, and if the firearm is a new firearm, the firearm is in its original package or not a new firearm, the firearm is in its case, so that would be an exemption to it. So you could go on a mass transit vehicle if you had your firearm in a case and without ammunition.
Thank you. Discussion on this amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, originally we had talked about having the exemption only for mass transit vehicles, not including school buses, and it looks like this is there. We just got these back. I apologize. It looks like this is, allows the exemption on a school bus as well, if it's in a case or if it's in a its original packaging. Is that correct?
I'd have to look, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I'd have to look at it because I just got these amendments myself.
Why don't you do that? We'll be in recess. We come back at 6 o'clock, and maybe we can have it after you.
Not sure.
So
we're here at 6.
We have one bill, and it'll be very intellectual. And so we are in recess until 6 o'clock.